Chapter 4 Loss of the Endurance. The ice did not trouble us again seriously until the end of September, though during the whole month the floes were seldom entirely without movement. The roar of pressure would come to us across the otherwise silent ice fields, and bring with it a threat and a warning. Watching from the crow's nest, we could see sometimes the formation of pressure ridges. The sunshine glittered on newly riven ice surfaces as the masses of shattered floe rose and fell away from the line of pressure. The area of disturbance would advance towards us, recede, and advance again. The routine of work and play on the Endurance proceeded steadily. Our plans and preparations for any contingency that might arise during the approaching summer had been made, but there seemed always plenty to do in and about our present ship. Runs with the dogs and vigorous games of hockey and football on the rough snow-covered floe kept all hands in good fettle. The record of one or two of these September days will indicate the nature of our life and our surroundings. September 4th. Temperature, -14.1°F, light easterly breeze, blue sky, and stratus clouds. During forenoon notice a distinct terracotta or biscuit color in the stratus clouds to the north. This traveled from east to west and could conceivably have come from some of the Graham Land volcanoes, now about 300 miles distant to the northwest. The upper current of air probably would come from that direction. Heavy rime. Pack and broken and unchanged as far as visible. No land for 22 miles. No animal life observed. September 7th. Temperature, -10.8°F, moderate easterly to southerly winds, overcast and misty, with light snow till midnight. When weather cleared, blue sky and fine clear weather to noon, much rime aloft, thick fresh snow on ship and floe that glistens brilliantly in the morning sunlight, little clouds of faint violet colored mist rise from the lower and brinier portions of the pack, which stretches unbroken to the horizon, very great refraction all round, a tabular berg about 50 feet high 10 miles west is a good index of the amount of refraction, on ordinary days it shows from the masthead, clear cut against the sky. With much refraction, the pack beyond at the back of it lifts up into view, today a broad expanse of miles of pack is seen above it. Numerous other bergs generally seen in silhouette are, at first sight, lost, but after a closer scrutiny they appear as large lumps or dark masses well below the horizon. Refraction generally results in too big an altitude when observing the sun for position, but today, the horizon is thrown up so much that the altitude is about 12 seconds too small. No land visible for 20 miles. No animal life observed. Lower Clarkstone net with 566 fathoms of wire, and hoisted up at 2.5 miles an hour by walking across the floe with the wire. Result rather meager, jellyfish and some fish larvae. Exercise dogs in sledge teams. The young dogs, under Crean's care, pull as well, though not so strongly, as the best team in the pack. Hercules for the last fortnight or more has constituted himself leader of the orchestra. Two or three times in the 24 hours he starts a howl, a deep, melodious howl, and in about 30 seconds he has the whole pack in full song, the great deep, booming, harmonious song of the half-wolf pack. By the middle of September we were running short of fresh meat for the dogs. The seals and penguins seemed to have abandoned our neighborhood altogether. Nearly 5 months had passed since we killed a seal, and penguins had been seen seldom. Clark, who was using his trawl as often as possible, reported that there was a marked absence of plankton in the sea, and we assumed that the seals and the penguins had gone in search of their accustomed food. The men got an emperor on the 23rd. The dogs, which were having their sledging exercise, became wildly excited when the penguin, which had risen in a crack, was driven ashore, and the best efforts of the drivers failed to save it alive. On the following day Wild, Hurley, Macklin, and McElroy took their teams to the Steinberg, about 7 miles west of the ship, and on their way back got a female crab-eater, which they killed, skinned, and left to be picked up later. They ascended to the top of the berg, which lay in about latitude 69°30' south, longitude 51° west, and from an elevation of 110 feet could see no land. Samples of the discolored ice from the berg proved to contain dust with black gritty particles or sand grains. Another seal, a bull weddell, was secured on the 26th. The return of seal life was opportune, since we had nearly finished the winter supply of dog biscuit and wished to be able to feed the dogs on meat. The seals meant a supply of blubber, moreover, to supplement our small remaining stock of coal when the time came to get up steam again. We initiated a daylight saving system on this day by putting forward the clock 1 hour. This is really pandering to the base but universal passion that men, and especially seafarers, have for getting up late. Otherwise we would be honest and make our routine earlier instead of flogging the clock. During the concluding days of September the roar of the pressure grew louder, and I could see that the area of disturbance was rapidly approaching the ship. Stupendous forces were at work and the fields of firm ice around the Endurance were being diminished steadily. September 30th was a bad day. It began well, for we got two penguins and five seals during the morning. Three other seals were seen. But at 3 p.m. cracks that had opened during the night alongside the ship commenced to work in a lateral direction. The ship sustained terrific pressure on the port side forward, the heaviest shocks being under the fore rigging. It was the worst squeeze we had experienced. The decks shuddered and jumped, beams arched, and stanchions buckled and shook. I ordered all hands to stand by in readiness for whatever emergency might arise. Even the dogs seemed to feel the tense anxiety of the moment. But the ship resisted valiantly, and just when it appeared that the limit of her strength was being reached, the huge floe that was pressing down upon us cracked across and so gave relief. "The behavior of our ship in the ice has been magnificent," wrote Worsley. "Since we have been beset, her staunchness and endurance have been almost past belief again and again. She has been nipped with a million-ton pressure and risen nobly, falling clear of the water out on the ice. She has been thrown to and fro like a shuttlecock a dozen times. She has been strained, her beams arched upwards, by the fearful pressure, her very sides opened and closed again as she was actually bent and curved along her length, groaning like a living thing. It will be said if such a brave little craft should be finally crushed in the remorseless, slowly strangling grip of the Weddell pack after 10 months of the bravest and most gallant fight ever put up by a ship. The Endurance deserved all that could be said in praise of her. Shipwrights had never done sounder or better work, but how long could she continue the fight under such conditions? We were drifting into the congested area of the Western Weddell Sea, the worst portion of the worst sea in the world, where the pack, forced on irresistibly by wind and current, impinges on the western shore and is driven up in huge corrugated ridges and chaotic fields of pressure. The vital question for us was whether or not the ice would open sufficiently to release us, or at least give us a chance of release, before the drift carried us into the most dangerous area. There was no answer to be got from the silent bergs and the grinding floes, and we faced the month of October with anxious hearts. The leads in the pack appeared to have opened out a little on October 1st, but not sufficiently to be workable even if we had been able to release the Endurance from the floe. The day was come, cloudy and misty in the forenoon and clearer in the afternoon, when we observed well-defined parhelia. The ship was subjected to slight pressure at intervals. Two bull crab-eaters climbed onto the floe close to the ship and were shot by Wild. They were both big animals in prime condition, and I felt that there was no more need for anxiety as to the supply of fresh meat for the dogs. Seal liver made a welcome change in our own menu. The two bulls were marked, like many of their kind, with long parallel scars about 3 inches apart, evidently the work of the killers. A bull we killed on the following day had 4 parallel scars, 16 inches long, on each side of its body. They were fairly deep and one flipper had been nearly torn away. The creature must have escaped from the jaws of a killer by a very small margin. Evidently life beneath the pack is not always monotonous. We noticed that several of the bergs in the neighborhood of the ship were changing their relative positions more than they had done for months past. The floes were moving. Our position on Sunday, October 3rd, was latitude 69 degrees 14 seconds south, longitude 51 degrees 8 seconds west. During the night the floe holding the ship aft cracked in several places, and this appeared to have eased the strain on the rudder. The forenoon was misty, with falls of snow, but the weather cleared later in the day and we could see that the pack was breaking. New leads had appeared, while several old leads had closed. Pressure ridges had risen along some of the cracks. The thickness of the season's ice, now about 230 days old, was 4 feet 5 inches under 7 or 8 inches of snow. This ice had been slightly thicker in the early part of September, and I assumed that some melting had begun below. Clark had recorded plus temperatures at depths of 150 and 200 fathoms in the concluding days of September. The ice obviously had attained its maximum thickness by direct freezing, and the heavier older floes had been created by the consolidation of pressure ice and the overlapping of floes under strain. The air temperatures were still low, -24.5 degrees Fahrenheit being recorded on October 4th. The movement of the ice was increasing. Frost smoke from opening cracks was showing in all directions during October 6th. It had the appearance in one place of a great prairie fire, rising from the surface and getting higher as it drifted off before the wind in heavy, dark, rolling masses. At another point there was the appearance of a train running before the wind, the smoke rising from the locomotive straight upwards, and the smoke columns elsewhere gave the effect of warships steaming in line ahead. During the following day the leads and cracks opened to such an extent that if the Endurance could have been forced forward for 30 yards we could have proceeded for 2 or 3 miles, but the effort did not promise any really useful result. The conditions did not change materially during the rest of that week. The position on Sunday, October 10th, was latitude 69 degrees 21 seconds south, longitude 50 degrees 34 seconds west of Fall made things uncomfortable for us that day. The temperature had risen from negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit to plus 29.8 degrees Fahrenheit, the highest we had experienced since January, and the ship got dripping wet between decks. The upper deck was clear of ice and snow and the cabins became unpleasantly messy. The dogs, who hated wet, had a most unhappy air. Undoubtedly one grows to like familiar conditions. We had lived long in temperatures that would have seemed distressingly low in civilized life, and now we were made uncomfortable by a degree of warmth that would have left the unaccustomed human being still shivering. The thaw was an indication that winter was over, and we began preparations for reoccupying the cabins on the main deck. I had the shelter house round the stern pulled down on the 11th and made other preparations for working the ship as soon as she got clear. The carpenter had built a wheel house over the wheel aft as shelter in cold and heavy weather. The ice was still loosening and no land was visible for 20 miles. The temperature remained relatively high for several days. All hands moved to their summer quarters in the upper cabins on the 12th, to the accompaniment of much noise and laughter. Spring was in the air, and if there were no green growing things to gladden our eyes, there were at least many seals, penguins, and even whales disporting themselves in the leads. The time for renewed action was coming, and though our situation was grave enough, we were facing the future hopefully. The dogs were kept in a state of uproar by the sight of so much game. They became almost frenzied when a solemn-looking emperor penguin inspected them gravely from some point of vantage on the floe and gave utterance to an apparently derisive "Nark." At 7 p.m. on the 13th the ship broke free of the floe on which she had rested to starboard sufficiently to come upright. The rudder freed itself, but the propeller was found to be athwartship, having been forced into that position by the floe sometime after August 1st. The water was very clear and we could see the rudder, which appeared to have suffered only a slight twist to port at the water line. It moved quite freely. The propeller, as far as we could see, was intact, but it could not be moved by the hand gear, probably owing to a film of ice in the stern gland and sleeve. I did not think it advisable to attempt to deal with it at that stage. The ship had not been pumped for 8 months, but there was no water and not much ice in the bilges. Meals were served again in the wardroom that day. The southwesterly breeze freshened to a gale on the 14th, and the temperature fell from plus 31 degrees Fahrenheit to negative 1 degree Fahrenheit at midnight. The ship came free from the floe and drifted rapidly astern. Her head fell off before the wind until she lay nearly at right angles across the narrow lead. This was a dangerous position for rudder and propeller. The spanker was set, but the weight of the wind on the ship gradually forced the floes open until the Endurance swung right round and drove 100 yards along the lead. Then the ice closed and at 3 a.m. we were fast again. The wind died down during the day and the pack opened for 5 or 6 miles to the north. It was still loose on the following morning, and I had the boiler pumped up with the intention of attempting to clear the propeller, but one of the manholes developed a leak, the packing being perished by cold or loosened by contraction, and the boiler had to be emptied out. Again, the pack was rather closer on Sunday the 17th. Top sails and head sails were set in the afternoon, and with a moderate northeasterly breeze we tried to force the ship ahead out of the lead, but she was held fast. Later that day heavy pressure developed. The two floes between which the Endurance was lying began to close and the ship was subjected to a series of tremendously heavy strains. In the engine room, the weakest point, loud groans, crashes, and hammering sounds were heard. The iron plates on the floor buckled up and overrode with loud clangs. Meanwhile the floes were grinding off each other's projecting points and throwing up pressure ridges. The ship stood the strain well for nearly an hour and then, to my great relief, began to arise with heavy jerks and jars. She lifted 10 inches forward and 3 feet 4 inches aft, at the same time heeling 6 degrees to port. The ice was getting below us and the immediate danger had passed. The position was latitude 69 degrees 19 seconds south, longitude 50 degrees 40 seconds west. The next attack of the ice came on the afternoon of October 18. The two floes began to move laterally, exerting great pressure on the ship. Suddenly the floe on the port side cracked and huge pieces of ice shot up from under the port bilge. Within a few seconds the ship heeled over until she had a list of 30 degrees to port, being held under the starboard bilge by the opposing floe. The lee boats were now almost resting on the floe. The midship dog kennels broke away and crashed down onto the lee kennels, and the howls and barks of the frightened dogs assisted to create a perfect pandemonium. Everything movable on deck and below fell to the lee side, and for a few minutes it looked as if the Endurance would be thrown upon her beam ends. Order was soon restored. I had all fires put out and battens nailed on the deck to give the dogs a foothold and enable people to get about. Then the crew lashed all the movable gear. If the ship had heeled any farther, it would have been necessary to release the lee boats and pull them clear, and Worsley was watching to give the alarm. Hurley meanwhile descended to the floe and took some photographs of the ship in her unusual position. Dinner in the wardroom that evening was a curious affair. Most of the diners had to sit on the deck, their feet against battens and their plates on their knees. At 8 p.m. the floes opened, and within a few minutes the Endurance was nearly upright again. Orders were given for the ice to be chipped clear of the rudder. The men pulled the blocks out of the way when they had been detached from the floe with the long ice chisels, and we were able to haul the ship's stern into a clear berth. Then the boiler was pumped up. This work was completed early in the morning of October 19th, and during that day the engineer lit fires and got up steam very slowly, in order to economize fuel and avoid any strain on the chilled boilers by unequal heating. The crew cut up all loose lumber, boxes, etc., and put them in the bunkers for fuel. The day was overcast, with occasional snowfalls, the temperature plus 12 degrees Fahrenheit. The ice in our neighborhood was quiet, but in the distance pressure was at work. The wind freshened in the evening, and we ran a wire mooring astern. The barometer at 11 p.m. stood at 28.96, the lowest since the gales of July. An uproar among the dogs attracted attention late in the afternoon, and we found a 25-foot whale cruising up and down in our pool. It pushed its head up once in characteristic killer fashion, but we judged from its small curved dorsal fin that it was a specimen of Balaenoptera acutorostrata, not Orca gladiator. A strong southwesterly wind was blowing on October 20th and the pack was working. The Endurance was imprisoned securely in the pool, but our chance might come at any time. Watches were set so as to be ready for working ship. Wild and Hudson, Greenstreet and Cheatham, Worsley and Crean, took the deck watches, and the chief engineer and second engineer kept watch and watch with three of the A.P. single quote S4 stokers. The staff and the forward hands, with the exception of the cook, the carpenter and his mate, were on watch and watch, that is, 4 hours on deck and 4 hours below, or off duty. The carpenter was busy making a light punt, which might prove useful in the navigation of lanes and channels. At 11 a.m. we gave the engines a gentle trial turn astern. Everything worked well after 8 months of frozen inactivity, except that the bilge pump and the discharge proved to be frozen up. They were cleared with some little difficulty. The engineer reported that to get steam he had used 1 ton of coal, with wood ashes and blubber. The fires required to keep the boiler warm consumed 1¼ to 1½ hundredweight of coal per day. We had about 50 tons of coal remaining in the bunkers. October 21st and 22 were days of low temperature, which caused the open leads to freeze over. The pack was working, and ever and anon the roar of pressure came to our ears. We wait for the next move of the gigantic forces arrayed against us. The 23rd brought a strong northwesterly wind, and the movement of the flows and pressure ridges became more formidable. Then on Sunday, October 24th, there came what for the Endurance was the beginning of the end. The position was latitude 69 degrees 11 seconds south, longitude 51 degrees 5 seconds west. We had now 22½ hours of daylight, and throughout the day we watched the threatening advance of the flows. At 6:45 p.m. the ship sustained heavy pressure in a dangerous position. The attack of the ice is illustrated roughly in the appended diagram. The shaded portions represent the pool, covered with new ice that afforded no support to the ship, and the arrows indicate the direction of the pressure exercised by the thick flows and pressure ridges. The onslaught was all but irresistible. The Endurance groaned and quivered as her starboard quarter was forced against the floe, twisting the sternpost and starting the heads and ends of planking. The ice had lateral as well as forward movement, and the ship was twisted and actually bent by the stresses. She began to leak dangerously at once. I had the pumps rigged, got up steam, and started the bilge pumps at 8 p.m. The pressure by that time had relaxed. The ship was making water rapidly aft, and the carpenter set to work to make a cofferdam astern of the engines. All hands worked, watch and watch, throughout the night, pumping ship and helping the carpenter. By morning the leak was being kept in check. The carpenter and his assistants caulked the cofferdam with strips of blankets and nailed strips over the seams wherever possible. The main or hand pump was frozen up and could not be used at once. After it had been knocked out, Worsley, Greenstreet, and Hudson went down in the bunkers and cleared the ice from the bilges. "This is not a pleasant job," wrote Worsley. "We have to dig a hole down through the coal while the beams and timbers groan and crack all around us like pistol shots. The darkness is almost complete, and we mess about in the wet with half-frozen hands and try to keep the coal from slipping back into the bilges. The men on deck pour buckets of boiling water from the galley down the pike as we prod and hammer from below, and at last we get the pump clear, cover up the bilges to keep the coal out, and rush on deck, very thankful to find ourselves safe again, in the open air." Monday, October 25th, dawn cloudy and misty, with a minus temperature and a strong southeasterly breeze. All hands were pumping at intervals and assisting the carpenter with the cofferdam. The leak was being kept under fairly easily, but the outlook was bad. Heavy pressure ridges were forming in all directions, and though the immediate pressure upon the ship was not severe, I realized that the respite would not be prolonged. The pack within our range of vision was being subjected to enormous compression, such as might be caused by cyclonic winds, opposing ocean currents, or constriction in a channel of some description. The pressure ridges, massive and threatening, testified to the overwhelming nature of the forces that were at work. Huge blocks of ice, weighing many tons, were lifted into the air and tossed aside as other masses rose beneath them. We were helpless intruders in a strange world, our lives dependent upon the play of grim elementary forces that made a mock of our puny efforts. I scarcely dared hope now that the Endurance would live, and throughout that anxious day I reviewed again the plans made long before for the sledging journey that we must make in the event of our having to take to the ice. We were ready, as far as forethought could make us, for every contingency. Stores, dogs, sledges, and equipment were ready to be moved from the ship at a moment's notice. The following day brought bright clear weather, with a blue sky. The sunshine was inspiriting. The roar of pressure could be heard all around us. New ridges were rising, and I could see as the day wore on that the lines of major disturbance were drawing nearer to the ship. The Endurance suffered some strains at intervals. Listening below, I could hear the creaking and groaning of her timbers, the pistol-like cracks that told of the starting of a tree nail or plank, and the faint, indefinable whispers of our ship's distress. Overhead the sun shone serenely, occasional fleecy clouds drifted before the southerly breeze, and the light glinted and sparkled on the million facets of the new pressure ridges. The day passed slowly. At 7 p.m. very heavy pressure developed, with twisting strains that racked the ship fore and aft. The butts of planking were open 4 and 5 inches on the starboard side, and at the same time we could see from the bridge that the ship was bending like a bow under titanic pressure. Almost like a living creature, she resisted the forces that would crush her, but it was a one-sided battle. Millions of tons of ice pressed inexorably upon the little ship that had dared the challenge of the Antarctic. The Endurance was now leaking badly, and at 9 p.m. I gave the order to lower boats, gear, provisions, and sledges to the floe, and move them to the flat ice a little way from the ship. The working of the ice closed the leaks slightly at midnight, but all hands were pumping all night. A strange occurrence was the sudden appearance of 8 emperor penguins from a crack 100 yards away at the moment when the pressure upon the ship was at its climax. They walked a little way towards us, halted, and after a few ordinary calls proceeded to utter weird cries that sounded like a dirge for the ship. None of us had ever before heard the emperors utter any other than the most simple calls or cries, and the effect of this concerted effort was almost startling. Then came a fateful day, Wednesday, October 27th. The position was latitude 69 degrees 5 seconds south, longitude 51 degrees 30 seconds west. The temperature was -8.5°F. A gentle southerly breeze was blowing and the sun shone in a clear sky. After long months of ceaseless anxiety and strain, after times when hope beat high and times when the outlook was black indeed, the end of the Endurance has come. But though we have been compelled to abandon the ship, which is crushed beyond all hope of ever being righted. We are alive and well, and we have stores and equipment for the task that lies before us. The task is to reach land with all the members of the expedition. It is hard to write what I feel. To a sailor, his ship is more than a floating home, and in the Endurance I had centered ambitions, hopes, and desires. Now, straining and groaning, her timbers cracking and her wounds gaping, she is slowly giving up her sentient life at the very outset of her career. She is crushed and abandoned after drifting more than 570 miles in a northwesterly direction during the 281 days since she became locked in the ice. The distance from the point where she became beset to the place where she now rests mortally hurt in the grip of the floes is 573 miles, but the total drift through all observed positions has been 1186 miles, and probably we actually covered more than 1500 miles. We are now 346 miles from Paulet Island, the nearest point where there is any possibility of finding food and shelter. A small hut built there by the Swedish expedition in 1902 is filled with stores left by the Argentine relief ship. I know all about those stores, for I purchased them in London on behalf of the Argentine government when they asked me to equip the relief expedition. The distance to the nearest barrier west of us is about 180 miles, but the party going there would still be about 360 miles from Paulet Island, and there would be no means of sustaining life on the barrier. We could not take from here food enough for the whole journey, the weight would be too great. This morning, our last on the ship, the weather was clear, with a gentle south-southeasterly to south-southwesterly breeze. From the crow's nest there was no sign of land of any sort. The pressure was increasing steadily, and the passing hours brought no relief or respite for the ship. The attack of the ice reached its climax at 4 p.m. The ship was hove stern up by the pressure, and the driving floe, moving laterally across the stern, split the rudder and tore out the rudder post and stern post. Then, while we watched, the ice loosened and the Endurance sank a little. The decks were breaking upwards and the water was pouring in below. Again the pressure began, and at 5 p.m. I ordered all hands onto the ice. The twisting, grinding floes were working their will at last on the ship. It was a sickening sensation to feel the decks breaking up under one's feet, the great beams bending and then snapping with a noise like heavy gunfire. The water was overmastering the pumps, and to avoid an explosion when it reached the boilers I had to give orders for the fires to be drawn and the steam let down. The plans for abandoning the ship in case of emergency had been made well in advance, and men and dogs descended to the floe and made their way to the comparative safety of an unbroken portion of the floe without a hitch. Just before leaving, I looked down the engine room skylight as I stood on the quivering deck, and saw the engines dropping sideways as the stays and bed plates gave way. I cannot describe the impression of relentless destruction that was forced upon me as I looked down and around. The floes, with the force of millions of tons of moving ice behind them, were simply annihilating the ship. Essential supplies had been placed on the floe about 100 yards from the ship, and there we set about making a camp for the night. But about 7 p.m., after the tents were up, the ice we were occupying became involved in the pressure and started to split and smash beneath our feet. I had the camp moved to a bigger floe about 200 yards away, just beyond the bow of the ship. Boats, stores, and camp equipment had to be conveyed across a working pressure ridge. The movement of the ice was so slow that it did not interfere much with our short trek, but the weight of the ridge had caused the floes to sink on either side and there were pools of water there. A pioneer party with picks and shovels had to build a snow causeway before we could get all our possessions across. By 8 p.m. the camp had been pitched again. We had two pole tents and three hoop tents. I took charge of the small pole tent, number one, with Hudson, Hurley, and James as companions. Wild had the small hoop tent, number two, with Wordy, McNeish, and McElroy. These hoop tents are very easily shifted and set up. The eight forward hands had the large hoop tent, number three. Crean had charge of number four hoop tent with Hussey, Marston, and Cheatham, and Worsley had the other pole tent, number five, with Greenstreet, Lees, Clark, Kerr, Rickinson, Macklin, and Blackborough, the last name being the youngest of the forward hands. Tonight the temperature has dropped to negative 16 degrees Fahrenheit, and most of the men are cold and uncomfortable. After the tents had been pitched I mustered all hands and explained the position to them briefly and, I hope, clearly. I have told them the distance to the barrier and the distance to Paulet Island, and have stated that I propose to try to march with equipment across the ice in the direction of Paulet Island. I thank the men for the steadiness and good morale they had shown in these trying circumstances, and told them I had no doubt that, provided they continued to work their utmost and to trust me, we will all reach safety in the end. Then we had supper, which the cook had prepared at the big blubber stove, and after a watch had been set all hands except the watch turned in. For myself, I could not sleep. The destruction and abandonment of the ship was no sudden shock. The disaster had been looming ahead for many months, and I had studied my plans for all contingencies 100 times. But the thoughts that came to me as I walked up and down in the darkness were not particularly cheerful. The task now was to secure the safety of the party, and to that I must bend my energies and mental power and apply every bit of knowledge that experience of the Antarctic had given me. The task was likely to be long and strenuous, and an ordered mind and a clear program were essential if we were to come through without loss of life. A man must shape himself to a new mark directly the old one goes to ground. That midnight I was pacing the ice, listening to the grinding flow and to the groans and crashes that told of the death agony of the Endurance, when I noticed suddenly a crack running across our floe right through the camp. The alarm whistle brought all hands tumbling out, and we moved the tents and stores lying on what was now the smaller portion of the floe to the larger portion. Nothing more could be done at that moment, and the men turned in again, but there was little sleep. Each time I came to the end of my beat on the floe I could just see in the darkness the appearing piles of pressure ice, which toppled over and narrowed still further the little floating island we occupied. I did not notice at the time that my tent, which had been on the wrong side of the crack, had not been erected again. Hudson and James had managed to squeeze themselves into other tents, and Hurley had wrapped himself in the canvas of number one tent. I discovered this about 5 a.m. All night long the electric light gleamed from the stern of the dying Endurance. Hazady had left this light switched on when he took a last observation, and, like a lamp in a cottage window, it braved the night until in the early morning the Endurance received a particularly violent squeeze. There was a sound of rending beams and the light disappeared. The connection had been cut. Morning came in chill and cheerless. All hands were stiff and weary after their first disturbed night on the floe. Just at daybreak I went over to the Endurance with Wild and Hurley, in order to retrieve some tins of petrol that could be used to boil oat milk for the rest of the men. The ship presented a painful spectacle of chaos and wreck. The jib boom and bowsprit had snapped off during the night and now lay at right angles to the ship, with the chains, martingale, and bobstay dragging them as the vessel quivered and moved in the grinding pack. The ice had driven over the forecastle and she was well down by the head. We secured 2 tins of petrol with some difficulty, and postponed the further examination of the ship until after breakfast. Jumping across cracks with the tins, we soon reached camp, and built a fireplace out of the triangular watertight tanks we had ripped from the lifeboat. This we had done in order to make more room. Then we pierced a petrol tin in 6 places with an ice axe and set fire to it. The petrol blazed fiercely under the 5-gallon drum we used as a cooker, and the hot milk was ready in quick time. Then we 3 ministering angels went round the tents with the life-giving drink, and were surprised and a trifle chagrined at the matter-of-fact manner in which some of the men accepted this contribution to their comfort. They did not quite understand what work we had done for them in the early dawn, and I heard Wild say, "If any of you gentlemen would like your boots clean, just put them outside." This was his gentle way of reminding them that a little thanks will go a long way on such occasions. The cook prepared breakfast, which consisted of biscuit and hoosh, at 8 a.m., and I then went over to the Endurance again and made a fuller examination of the wreck. Only 6 of the cabins had not been pierced by floes and blocks of ice. Every one of the starboard cabins had been crushed. The whole of the after part of the ship had been crushed concertina fashion. The forecastle and the ritz were submerged, and the wardroom was 3/4 full of ice. The starboard side of the wardroom had come away. The motor engine forward had been driven through the galley. Petrol cases that had been stacked on the foredeck had been driven by the flow through the wall into the wardroom and had carried before them a large picture. Curiously enough, the glass of this picture had not been cracked, whereas in the immediate neighborhood I saw heavy iron davits that had been twisted and bent like the ironwork of a wrecked train. The ship was being crushed remorselessly. Under a dull, overcast sky I returned to camp and examined our situation. The floe occupied by the camp was still subject to pressure, and I thought it wise to move to a larger and apparently stronger floe about 200 yards away, off the starboard bow of the ship. This camp was to become known as Dump Camp, owing to the amount of stuff that was thrown away there. We could not afford to carry unnecessary gear, and a drastic sorting of equipment took place. I decided to issue a complete new set of Burberry's and underclothing to each man, and also a supply of new socks. The camp was transferred to the larger floe quickly, and I began there to direct the preparations for the long journey across the floes to Paulet Island or Snow Hill. Hurley meanwhile had rigged his kinematograph camera and was getting pictures of the Endurance in her death throes. While he was engaged thus, the ice, driving against the standing rigging and the fore, main and mizzen masts, snapped the shrouds. The foretop and t'gallant mast came down with a run and hung in wreckage on the foremast, with the foreyard vertical. The main mast followed immediately, snapping off about 10 feet above the main deck. The crow's nest fell within 10 feet of where Hurley stood turning the handle of his camera, but he did not stop the machine, and so secured a unique, though sad, picture. The issue of clothing was quickly accomplished. Sleeping bags were required also. We had 18 fur bags, and it was necessary, therefore, to issue 10 of the Jaeger woolen bags in order to provide for the 28 men of the party. The woolen bags were lighter and less warm than the reindeer bags, and so each man who received one of them was allowed also a reindeer skin to lie upon. It seemed fair to distribute the fur bags by lot, but some of us older hands did not join in the lottery. We thought we could do quite as well with the Jaegers as with the furs. With quick dispatch the clothing was apportioned, and then we turned one of the boats on its side and supported it with two broken oars to make a lee for the galley. The cook got the blubber stuff going, and a little later, when I was sitting round the corner of the stuff, I heard one man say, "Cook, I like my tea strong." Another joined him, "Cook, I like mine weak." It was pleasant to know that their minds weren't troubled, but I thought the time opportune to mention that the tea would be the same for all hands and that we would be fortunate if 2 months later we had any tea at all. It occurred to me at the time that the incident had psychological interest. Here were men, their home crushed, the camp pitched on the unstable floes, and their chance of reaching safety apparently remote, calmly attending to the details of existence and giving their attention to such trifles as the strength of a brew of tea. During the afternoon the work continued. Every now and then we heard a noise like heavy guns or distant thunder, caused by the floes grinding together. The pressure caused by the congestion in this area of the pack is producing a scene of absolute chaos. The floes grind stupendously, throw up great ridges, and shatter one another mercilessly. The ridges, or hedgerows, marking the pressure lines that border the fast diminishing pieces of smooth floe ice, are enormous. The ice moves majestically, irresistibly. Human effort is not futile, but man fights against the giant forces of nature in a spirit of humility. One has a sense of dependence on the higher power. Today two seals, a Weddell and a Grey Beaver, came close to the camp and were shot. 4 others were chased back into the water, for their presence disturbed the dog teams, and this meant floggings and trouble with the harness. The arrangement of the tents has been completed and their internal management settled. Each tent has a mess orderly, the duty being taken in turn on an alphabetical rota. The orderly takes the hoosh pots of his tent to the galley, gets all the hoosh he is allowed, and, after the meal, cleans the vessels with snow and stores them in sledge or boat ready for a possible move. October 29th. We passed a quiet night, although the pressure was grinding around us. Our floe is a heavy one and it withstood the blows it received. There is a light wind from the northwest to north-northwest, and the weather is fine. We are 28 men with 49 dogs, including Suzanne Sully's 5 grown-up pups. All hands this morning were busy preparing gear, fitting boats on sledges, and building up and strengthening the sledges to carry the boats. The main motor sledge, with a little fitting from the carpenter, carried our largest boat admirably. For the next boat 4 ordinary sledges were lashed together, but we were dubious as to the strength of this contrivance, and as a matter of fact it broke down quickly under strain. The ship is still afloat, with the spurs of the pack driven through her and holding her up. The forecastle head is underwater, the decks are burst up by the pressure, the wreckage lies around in dismal confusion, but overall the blue ensign flies still. This afternoon Sully's 3 youngest pups, Sue Sirius, and Mrs. Chippy, the carpenter's cat, have to be shot. We could not undertake the maintenance of weaklings under the new conditions. Macklin, Crin, and the carpenter seem to feel the loss of their friends rather badly. We propose making a short trial journey tomorrow, starting with 2 of the boats and the 10 sledges. The number of dog teams has been increased to 7, Greenstreet taking charge of the new additional team, consisting of Snapper and Sully's 4 oldest pups. We have 10 working sledges to a relay with 5 teams. Wilds and Hurley's teams will haul the cutter with the assistance of 4 men. The whaler and the other boats will follow, and the men who are hauling them will be able to help with the cutter at the rough places. We cannot hope to make rapid progress, but each mile counts. Crean this afternoon has a bad attack of snow blindness. The weather on the morning of October 30th was overcast and misty, with occasional falls of snow. A moderate northeasterly breeze was blowing. We were still living on extra food, brought from the ship when we abandoned her, and the sledging and boating rations were intact. These rations would provide for 28 men for 56 days on full rations, but we could count on getting enough seal and penguin meat to at least double this time. We could even, if progress proved too difficult and too injurious to the boats, which we must guard as our ultimate means of salvation, camp on the nearest heavy floe, scour the neighboring pack for penguins and seals, and await the outward rift of the pack, to open and navigable water. This plan would avoid the grave dangers we are now incurring of getting entangled in impassable pressure ridges and possibly irretrievably damaging the boats, which are bound to suffer in rough ice. It would also minimize the peril of the ice splitting under us, as it did twice during the night, at our first camp. Yet I feel sure that it is the right thing to attempt a march, since if we can make 5 or 7 miles a day to the northwest, our chance of reaching safety in the months to come will be increased greatly. There is a psychological aspect to the question also. It will be much better for the men in general to feel that, even though progress is slow, they are on their way to a land than it will be simply to sit down and wait for the tardy northwesterly drift to take us out of this cruel waste of ice. We will make an attempt to move. The issue is beyond my power either to predict or to control. That afternoon Wild and I went out in the mist and snow to find a road to the northeast. After many devious turnings to avoid the heavier pressure ridges, we pioneered away for at least a mile and a half, and then returned by a rather better route to the camp. The pressure now was rapid in movement and our floe was suffering from the shakes and jerks of the ice. At 3 p.m., after lunch, we got underway, leaving dump camp a mass of debris. The order was that personal gear must not exceed 2 pounds per man, and this meant that nothing but their necessaries was to be taken on the march. We could not afford to cumber ourselves with unnecessary weight. Holes had been dug in the snow for the reception of private letters and little personal trifles, the lairs and penates of the members of the expedition, and into the privacy of these white graves were consigned much of sentimental value and not a little of intrinsic worth. I rather grudged the 2 pounds allowance per man, owing to my keen anxiety to keep weights at a minimum, but some personal belongings could fairly be regarded as indispensable. The journey might be a long one, and there was a possibility of a winter in improvised quarters on an inhospitable coast at the other end. A man under such conditions needs something to occupy his thoughts, some tangible memento of his home and people beyond the seas. So sovereigns were thrown away and photographs were kept. I tore the flyleaf out of the Bible that Queen Alexandra had given to the ship, with her own writing in it, and also the wonderful page of Job containing the verse, "Out of whose womb came the ice, and the hoary frost of heaven, who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." Job 38:29-30. The other Bible, which Queen Alexandra had given for the use of the shore party, was down below in the lower hold in one of the cases when the ship received her death blow. Suitcases were thrown away, these were retrieved later as material for making boots, and some of them, marked solid leather, proved, to our disappointment, to contain a large percentage of cardboard. The manufacturer would have had difficulty in convincing us at the time that the deception was anything short of criminal. The pioneer sledge party, consisting of Wordy, Hussey, Hudson, and myself, carrying picks and shovels, started to break a road through the pressure ridges for the sledges carrying the boats. The boats, with their gear and the sledges beneath them, weighed each more than a ton. The cutter was smaller than the whaler, but weighed more and was a much more strongly built boat. The whaler was mounted on the sledge part of the Girling tractor forward and 2 sledges amidships and aft. These sledges were strengthened with cross timbers and shortened oars fore and aft. The cutter was mounted on the arrow sledge. The sledges were the point of weakness. It appeared almost hopeless to prevent them smashing under their heavy loads when traveling over rough pressure ice which stretched ahead of us for probably 300 miles. After the pioneer sledge had started, the 7 dog teams got off. They took their sledges forward for half a mile, then went back for the other sledges. Worsley took charge of the 2 boats, with 15 men hauling, and these also had to be relayed. It was heavy work for dogs and men, but there were intervals of comparative rest on the backward journey. After the first portion of the load had been taken forward, we passed over to opening cracks, through which killers were pushing their ugly snouts, and by 5 p.m. had covered a mile in a north-northwesterly direction. The condition of the ice ahead was chaotic, for since the morning increased pressure had developed and the pack was moving and crushing in all directions. So I gave the order to pitch camp for the night on flat ice, which, unfortunately, proved to be young and salty. The older pack was too rough and too deeply laden with snow to offer a suitable camping ground. Although we had gained only 1 mile in a direct line, the necessary deviations made the distance traveled at least 2 miles, and the relays brought the distance marched up to 6 miles. Some of the dog teams had covered at least 10 miles. I set the watch from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m., 1 hour for each man in each tent in rotation. During the night snow fell heavily, and the floor cloths of the tents got wet through. As the temperature had risen to plus 25 degrees Fahrenheit, one of the things we hoped for in those days was a temperature in the neighborhood of zero, for then the snow surface would be hard, we would not be troubled by damp, and our gear would not become covered in soft snow. The killers were blowing all night, and a crack appeared about 20 feet from the camp at 2 a.m. The ice below us was quite thin enough for the killers to break through if they took a fancy to do so, but there was no other camping ground within our reach and we had to take the risk. When morning came, the snow was falling so heavily that we could not see more than a few score yards ahead, and I decided not to strike camp. A path over the shattered floes would be hard to find, and to get the boats into a position of peril might be disastrous. Rickinson and Worsley started back for dump camp at 7 a.m. to get some wood and blubber for the fire, and an hour later we had hoosh, with one biscuit each. At 10 a.m. Hurley and Hudson left for the old camp in order to bring some additional dog pemmican, since there were no seals to be found near us. Then, as the weather cleared, Worsley and I made a prospect to the west and tried to find a practicable road. A large floe offered a fairly good road for at least another mile to the northwest, and we went back prepared for another move. The weather cleared a little, and after lunch we struck camp. I took Rickinson, Kerr, Wordy, and Hudson as a breakdown gang to pioneer a path among the pressure ridges. 5 dog teams followed. Wild's and Hurley's teams were hitched onto the cutter and they started off in splendid style. They needed to be helped only once, indeed 14 dogs did as well or even better than 18 men. The ice was moving beneath and around us as we worked towards the big floe, and where this floe met the smaller ones there was a mass of pressed up ice, still in motion, with water between the ridges. But it is wonderful what a dozen men can do with picks and shovels. We could cut a road through a pressure ridge about 14 feet high in 10 minutes and leave a smooth, or comparatively smooth, path for the sledges and teams.